Buffalo Bob. I stopped, naked, and looking at my own wide-eyed reflection in the mirror over the dresser. Now I remembered the dream, and it was no wonder I'd awoken feeling sad. I'd dreamed I was in the teacher's room, reading adult English themes, while down the hall, in the gymnasium, another high school basketball game wound down toward another final buzzer. My wife was just out of rehab. I was hoping that she'd be home when I got there and I wouldn't have to spend an hour on the phone before locating her and fishing her out of some local waterhole. In the dream, I had shifted Harry Dunning's essay to the top of the pile and began to read. It wasn't a day, but a night. The night that changed my life was the night my father murdered my mother and two brothers. That had gotten my full attention, and in a hurry. Well, it would get anybody's, wouldn't it? But my eyes had only begun to sting when I got to the part about what he'd been wearing. The outfit made perfect sense, too. When kids went out on that special fall night carrying empty bags they hoped to bring back filled with sweet swag, their costumes always reflected the current craze. 5 years ago, it seemed that every second boy who showed up at my door was wearing Harry Potter eyeglasses and a lightning bolt scar decal on his forehead. On my own maiden voyage as a candy beggar many moons ago, I'd gone clanking down the sidewalk, with my mother trailing 10 feet behind me, at my urgent request, dressed as a snowtrooper from The Empire Strikes Back. So was it surprising that Harry Dunning had been wearing buckskin? "Cowabunga, Buffalo Bob," I told my reflection and suddenly ran for my study. I don't keep all student work. No teacher does. You drown in it. But I made a habit of photocopying the best essays. They make great teaching tools. I never would have used Harry's in class. It was far too personal for that. But I thought I remembered making a copy of it just the same because it had provoked such a strong emotional reaction in me. I pulled open the bottom drawer and began thumbing through the rat's nest of folders and loose papers. After 15 sweaty minutes, I found it. I sat down in my desk chair and began to read. It wasn't the day, but a night. The night that changed my life was the night my father murdered my mother and two brothers and hurt me bad. He hurt my sister, too. So bad she went into a coma. In 3 years she died without waking up. Her name was Ellen, and I loved her very much. She loved to pick flowers and put them in vases. What happened was like a horror movie. I never go see horror movies, because on Halloween night in 1958, I lived through one. My brother Troy was too old for trick and treat. 15. He was watching TV with my mother and said he would help us eat our candy when we came back. And Ellen, she said, no, you won't. Dress up and get your own. And everybody laughed because we all loved Ellen. She was only 7, but she was a real Lucille Ball. She could make anybody laugh, even my father. If he was sober, that is. When he was drunk, he was always mad. She was going as Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring. I look it up, and that's how you spell it. And I was going with Buffalo Bob, both from the Howdy Doody show we like to watch. Say, kids, what time is it? And let's hear from the peanut gallery. And cowabunga, Buffalo Bob. Me and Ellen love that show. She loved the princess, and I love Buffalo Bob. And we both love Howdy. We wanted my brother Tugger. His name was Arthur, but everyone called him Tugger. I don't remember why. To go as Mayor Phineas T. Bluster. But he wouldn't. He said Howdy Doody was a baby show. He was going as Frankenstein. Even though Ellen, she said that mask was too scary. Also, Tugger, he gave me some S-H-I-T about taking my Daisy air rifle because he said Buffalo Bob didn't have any guns on the TV show. And my mother, she said, you take it if you want to, Harry. It's not a real gun, or even shoot pretend bullets. So Buffalo Bob wouldn't mind. That was the last thing she ever said to me. And I'm glad it was a nice thing, because she could be strict. So we was getting ready to go, and I said, wait a second, I have to go to the bathroom, because I was so excited. They all laughed at me, even Mom and Troy on the couch. But going to pee then saved my life, because that was when my dad come in with that hammer. My dad, he was mean when he drank and beat up my mom time and again. One time when Troy tried to stop him by arguing him out of it, he broke Troy's arm. That time he almost went to jail. My dad, I mean. Anyway, my mom and dad were separated at this time I'm writing about, and she was thinking about divorcing him, but that wasn't so easy back in 1958 like it is now. Anyway, he came in the door, and I was in the bathroom peeing, and I heard my mother say, get out of here with that thing. You're not supposed to be here. The next thing was she started to scream. Then after that, they was all screaming. There was more. Three terrible pages. But it wasn't me who had to read them. It was still a few minutes shy of 6:30, but I found Al in the phone book and punched in his number without hesitation. I didn't wake him up either. He answered on the first ring, his voice more like a dog's bark than human speech. Hey, buddy! Ain't you the early bird? I've got something to show you. A student theme. You even know who wrote it. You ought to. You've got his picture on your celebrity wall. He coughed, then said, I got a lot of pictures on the celebrity wall, buddy. I think there might even be one of Frank Ancietti back around the time of the first Moxie Festival. Help me out a little here. I'd rather show you. Can I come over? If you can take me in my bathrobe, you can come over. But I gotta ask you straight up, now that you've had a night to sleep on it, have you decided? I think I have to make another trip back first. I hung up before he could ask any more questions. He looked worse than ever in the early light flooding in through his living room window. His white terry cloth robe hung around him like a deflated parachute. Passing up the chemo had allowed him to keep his hair, but it was thinning and baby fine. His eyes appeared to have retreated even farther into their sockets. He read Harry Dunning's theme twice, started to put it down, then read it again. At last he looked up at me and said, Jesus H. Christ on a chariot-driven crutch. The first time I read it, I cried. I don't blame you. The part about the Daisy air rifle is what really gets me. Back in the 50s, there was an ad for Daisy air rifles on the back of just about every goddamn comic book that hit the stands. Every kid on my block, every boy anyway, wanted just two things, a Daisy air rifle and a Davy Crockett coonskin cap. He's right, there were no bullets, even pretend ones, but we used to tip a little Johnson's baby oil down the barrel. Then, when you pumped air into it and pulled the trigger, you got a puff of blue smoke. He looked down at the photocopied pages again. Son of a bitch killed his wife and three of his kids with a hammer. Jesus. He just started laying on with it, Harry had written. I run back into the living room, and there was blood all over the walls and white stuff on the couch. That was my mother's brains. Ellen? She was laying on the floor with the rocker chair on top of her legs and blood coming out of her ears and hair. The TV was still on. It was this show my mom liked about Ellery Queen, who solved crimes. The crime that night had been nothing like the bloodlessly elegant problems Ellery Queen unraveled. It had been a slaughter. The 10-year-old boy who stopped to pee before going out trick-or-treating came back from the bathroom in time to see his drunken, roaring father split the head of Arthur Tugga Dunning as Tugga tried to crawl into the kitchen. Then he turned and saw Harry, who raised the Daisy air rifle and said, "Leave me alone, Daddy, or I'll shoot you." Dunning rushed at the boy, swinging the bloody hammer. Harry fired the air rifle at him. I could hear the ka-chow sound it must have made, even if I had never fired one myself, then dropped it and ran for the bedroom he shared with the now deceased Tugga. His father had neglected to shut the front door when he came in, and somewhere, "It sounded 1,000 miles away," the janitor had written. Neighbors were shouting, and trick-or-treating kids were screaming. Dunning would almost certainly have killed the remaining son as well if he hadn't tripped on the overturned rocker chair. He went sprawling, got up, and ran down to his younger son's room. Harry was trying to crawl under the bed. His father hauled him out and fetched him a lick on the side of the head that surely would have killed the boy if the father's hand hadn't slipped on the bloody handle. Instead of splitting Harry's skull, the hammerhead had only caved in part of it above the right ear. "I didn't pass out, but almost. I kept crawling for under the bed, and I hardly felt him hit my leg at all, but he did, and broke it in 4 different places. A man from down the block, who'd been out canvassing the neighborhood for candy with his daughter, came running in at that point. In spite of the slaughter in the living room, the neighbor had the presence of mind to grab the ash shovel out of the tool bucket beside the kitchen wood stove. He slugged Dunning in the back of the head with it while the man was trying to turn the bed over and get at his bleeding, semi-conscious son. "Afterward, I went unconscious like Ellen, only I was lucky I woke up. The doctor said they might have to amputate my leg, but in the end they didn't." No, he had kept the leg and eventually become a janitor at Lisbon High School, known to generations of students as Hop-Toed Harry. Would the kids have been kinder if they'd known the origin of the limp? Probably not. Although emotionally delicate and eminently bruisable, teenagers are short on empathy. That comes later in life, if it comes at all. "October of 1958, Al said in his harsh dog-bark voice. "Am I supposed to believe that's a coincidence?" I remembered what I'd said to the teenage version of Frank Ancietti about the Shirley Jackson story and smiled. Sometimes a cigar is just a smoke and a coincidence is just a coincidence. All I know is that we're talking about another watershed moment. "And I didn't find this story in the Enterprise because..." It didn't happen around here. It happened in Derry, upstate. When Harry was well enough to get out of the hospital, he went to live with his uncle and aunt in Haven, about 25 miles south of Derry. They adopted him and put him to work on the family farm when it became clear he couldn't keep up in school.
"Sounds like Oliver Twist or something."
No, they were good to him. Remember, there were no remedial classes in those days, and the phrase mentally challenged hadn't been invented yet.
"I know," Al said dryly. "Back then, mentally challenged means you're either a feeb, a dummy, or just plain addlepated."
"But he wasn't then, and he isn't now," I said. "Not really. I think mostly it was the shock, you know, the trauma." It took him years to recover from that night, and by the time he did, school was behind him.
"At least until he went back for his GED, and by then he was middle-aged, going on old."
Al shook his head.
"What a waste."
"Bullshit," I said. "A good life is never wasted. Could it have been better? Yes. Can I make that happen? Based on yesterday, maybe I can. But that's not really the point."
"Well, then what is? Because to me, this looks like Carolyn Poulin all over again. And that case is already proved. Yes, you can change the past. And no, the world doesn't just pop like a balloon when you do it. Would you pour me a fresh cup of coffee, Jake? Get yourself one while you're at it. It's hot, and you look like you could use one."
While I was pouring the coffee, I spied some sweet rolls. When I offered him one, he shook his head.
"Solid food hurts going down. But if you're determined to make me swallow calories, there's a 6-pack of Ensure in the fridge. In my opinion, it tastes like chilled snot, but I can choke it down."
When I brought it in one of the wine goblets I'd spied in his cupboard, he laughed hard.
"Think that'll make it taste any better?"
"Maybe, if you pretend it's Pinot Noir." He drank half of it, and I could see him struggling with his gorge to keep it down. That was a battle he won, but he pushed the goblet away and picked up the coffee mug again. Didn't drink from it, just wrapped his hands around it as if trying to take some of its warmth into himself. Watching this, I recalculated the amount of time he might have left.
"So," he said, "why is this different?"
If he hadn't been so sick, he would have seen it for himself. He was a bright guy. "Because Carolyn Pullen was never a very good test case. You didn't save her life, Al, only her legs. She went on to have a good but completely normal existence on both tracks, the one where Colum shot her and the one where you stepped in. She never married on either track. There were no kids on either track. It's like..." I fumbled. "No offense, Al, but what you did was like a doctor saving an infected appendix. Great for the appendix, but it's never going to do anything vital, even if it's healthy. Do you see what I'm saying?"
"Yes."
But I thought he looked a little peeved.
"Carolyn Poulin looked like the best I could do, buddy. At my age, time is limited, even when you're healthy. I had my eyes on a bigger prize."
"I'm not criticizing, but the Dunning family makes a better test case because it's not just a young girl, paralyzed, terrible as something like that must have been for her and her family. We're talking about four people murdered and a fifth maimed for life. Also, we know him. After he got his GED, I brought him down to the diner for a burger, and when you saw his cap and gown, you paid. Remember that?"
"Yeah. That's when I took the picture for my wall."
"If I can do this, if I can stop his old man from swinging that hammer, do you think that picture will still be there?"
"I don't know," Al said. "Maybe not. I might not even remember it was there in the first place."
That was a little too theoretical for me, and I passed it without comment. "And think about the three other kids, Troy, Ellen, and Tugga. Surely some of them will get married if they live to grow up, and maybe Ellen becomes a famous comedian. Doesn't he say in there that she was as funny as Lucille Ball?" I leaned forward. "The only thing I want is a better example of what happens when you change a watershed moment. I need that before I go monkeying with something as big as the Kennedy assassination. What do you say, Al?"
"I say that I see your point."
Al struggled to his feet. It was painful to watch him, but when I started to get up, he waved me back.
"No, stay there. I've got something for you. It's in the other room. I'll get it."
It was a tin box. He handed it to me and told me to carry it into the kitchen. He said it would be easier to lay stuff out on the table. When we were seated, he unlocked it with a key he wore around his neck. The first thing he took out was a bulky manila envelope. He opened it and shook out a large and untidy pile of paper money. I plucked one leaf from all that lettuce and looked at it wonderingly. It was a 20, but instead of Andrew Jackson on the face, I saw Grover Cleveland, who would probably not be on anyone's top 10 list of great American presidents. On the back was a locomotive and a steamship that looked destined for a collision beneath the words Federal Reserve Note. "This looks like Monopoly money."
"It's not. And there's not as much there as it probably looks like, because there are no bills bigger than a 20. These days, when a fill-up can run you $30, $35, a 50 raises no eyebrows even at a convenience store. Back then, it's different. And raised eyebrows, you don't need."
"This is your gambling dough?"
"Some. It's mostly my savings. I worked as a cook between 58 and 62. Same as here. And a man on his own can save a lot, especially if you don't run with expensive women, which I didn't. Or cheap ones, for that matter. I stayed on friendly terms with everybody and got close to nobody. I advise you do the same. In Derry and in Dallas, if you go there."
He stirred the money with one thin finger. There's a little over 9 grand. Best I can remember. It buys what 60 would today. I stared at the cash. Money comes back. It stays, no matter how many times you use the rabbit hole? We'd been over this point, but I was still trying to get it through my head.
Yeah, although it's still back there, too. Complete reset, remember?
Isn't that a paradox? He looked at me, haggard, patience wearing thin.
I don't know. Asking questions that don't have answers is a waste of time, and I don't have much.
Sorry. Sorry. What else have you got in there?
Not much. But the beauty of it is that you don't need much. It was a very different time, Jake. You can read about it in the history books, but you can't really understand it until you've lived there for a while.
He passed me a Social Security card. The number was 005-52-0223. The name was George T. Amberson. Al took a pen out of the box and handed it to me.
Sign it.
I took the pen, which was a promotional giveaway. Written on the barrel was, "Trust your car to the man who wears the star, Texaco." Feeling a little like Daniel Webster making his pact with the devil, I signed the card. When I tried to give it back to him, he shook his head. The next item was George T. Amberson's main driver's license, which stated I was 6'5", blue eyes, brown hair, weight 190. I'd been born on April 22, 1923, and lived at 19 Bluebird Lane in Sabattis, which happened to be my 2011 address.
6'5" about right? Al asked. I had to guess.
Close enough. I signed the driver's license, which was your basic piece of cardboard. Color, bureaucratic beige. No photo?
State of Maine's years away on that, buddy. The other 48, too.
48?
Hawaii won't be a state until next year.
Oh. I felt a little out of breath, as if someone had just punched me in the gut.
So, you get stopped for speeding and the cop just assumes you are who this card claims you are? Why not? If you say something about a terrorist attack in 1958, people are going to think you're talking about teenagers tipping cows. Sign these two.
He handed me a Hertz courtesy card, a city service gas card, a diner's club card, and an American Express card. The Amex was celluloid. The diner's club, cardboard. George Amberson's name was on them. Typed, not printed.
You can get a genuine plastic Amex card next year, if you want.
I smiled. No checkbook?
I could have got you one, but what good would it do? Any paperwork I filled out on George Amberson's behalf would be lost in the next reset. Also, any cash I put into the account.
Oh, I felt like a dummy.
Right. Don't get down on yourself. All this is still new to you. You want to start an account, though.
I'd suggest no more than 1,000. Keep most of the dough in cash. And where you can grab it, in case I have to come back in a hurry.
Right. And the credit cards are just identity backers. The actual accounts I opened to get them are going to be wiped out when you go back through. They might come in handy, though. You can never tell.
Does George get his mail at 19 Bluebird Lane?
In 1958, Bluebird Lane's just an address on a Sabattis plat map, buddy. The development where you live hasn't been built yet.
If anybody asks you about that, just say it's a business thing. They'll buy it. Business is like a god in 58. Everybody worships it, but nobody understands it. Here. He tossed me a gorgeous man's wallet. I gaped at it.
Is this ostrich? I wanted you to look prosperous, Al said. Find some pictures to put in it along with your identification. I got you some other odds and ends, too. More ballpoint pens. One a fad item with a combination letter opener and ruler on the end. A scripto-mechanical pencil. A pocket protector.
In 58, they're considered necessary, not nerdy. A bull of a watch on a Spydell chrome expansion band. All the cool cats will dig that one, Daddy. You can sort the rest out for yourself. He coughed long and hard, wincing. When he stopped, sweat was standing out on his face in large drops. Al, when did you put all this together?
When I realized I wasn't going to make it into 1963, I left Texas and came home. I already had you in mind. Divorced, no children, smart, best of all, young. Oh, here, almost forgot. This is the seed everything else grew from. Got the name off a gravestone in the St. Cyril's Boneyard, and just wrote an application letter to the Maine Secretary of State.
He handed me my birth certificate. I ran my fingers over the embossed franking. It had a silky, official feel. When I looked up, I saw he'd put another sheet of paper on the table. It was headed, Sports, 1958 through 1963.
Don't lose it. Not only because it's your meal ticket, but because you'd have a lot of questions to answer if it fell into the wrong hands. Especially when the picks start to prove out.
I started to put everything back into the box, and he shook his head.
Ah, I've got a Lord Buxton briefcase for you in my closet, all nicely battered around the edges.
I don't need it. I've got my backpack. It's in the trunk of my car. He looked amused.
Where you're going, nobody wears backpacks, except Boy Scouts, and they only wear them when they're going on hikes and camporees. You've got a lot to learn, buddy, but if you step careful and don't take chances, you'll get there.
I realized I was really going to do this, and it was going to happen right away, with almost no preparation. I felt like a visitor to the London docks of the 17th century who suddenly becomes aware he's about to be shanghaied. But what do I do? This came out in a near bleat. He raised his eyebrows, bushy and now as white as the thinning hair on his head.
You saved the Dunning family. Isn't that what we've been talking about?
I don't mean that. What do I do? When people ask me how I make my living, what do I say?
Your rich uncle died, remember? Tell them you're piecing your windfall inheritance out a little at a time, making it last long enough for you to write a book. Isn't there a frustrated writer inside every English teacher? Or am I wrong about that?
Actually, he wasn't. He sat looking at me, haggard, far too thin, but not without sympathy. Perhaps even pity. At last he said very softly,
"It's big, isn't it?"
"It is," I said. "And Al, man, I'm just a little guy."
"You could say the same of Oswald, a pipsqueak who shot from ambush. And according to Harry Dunning's theme, his father's just a mean drunk. With a hammer."
"He's not even that anymore. He died of acute stomach poisoning in Shawshank State Prison. Harry said it was probably bad squeeze."
"That's... I know what squeeze is.
I saw plenty when I was stationed in the Philippines. Even drank some, to my sorrow.
But he's not dead where you're going. Oswald either."
"Al, I know you're sick and I know you're in pain. But can you come down to the diner with me? For the first and last time, I used his habitual form of address. "Buddy, I don't want to start this alone.
I'm scared. Wouldn't miss it."
He hooked a hand under his armpit and stood up with a grimace that rolled his lips back to the gum lines.
"You get the briefcase. I'll get dressed."
It was 7:45 when Al unlocked the door of the silver trailer that the famous Fatburger called home. The glimmering chrome fixtures behind the counter looked ghostly. The stools seemed to whisper, "No one will sit on us again." The big old-fashioned sugar shakers seemed to whisper back, "No one will pour from us again. The party's over." "Make way for L.L. Bean," I said.
"That's right," Al said. "The fucking march of progress."
He was out of breath, panting, but didn't pause to rest. He led me behind the counter and to the pantry door. I followed, switching the briefcase with my new life inside it, from one hand to the other. It was the old-fashioned kind, with buckles. If I'd carried it into my homeroom at LHS, most of the kids would have laughed. A few others, those with an emerging sense of style, might have applauded its retro funk. Al opened the door on the smells of vegetables, spices, and coffee. He once more reached past my shoulder to turn on the light. I gazed at the gray linoleum floor the way a man might stare at a pool that could well be filled with hungry sharks, and when Al tapped me on the shoulder, I jumped.
"Sorry," he said, "but you ought to take this."
He was holding out a 50-cent piece, half a rock.
"The yellow card man, remember him?"
"Sure I do." Actually, I'd forgotten all about him. My heart was beating hard enough to make my eyeballs feel like they were pulsing in their sockets. My tongue tasted like an old piece of carpet, and when he handed me the coin, I almost dropped it. He gave me a final critical look.
"The jeans are okay for now, but you have to stop at Mason's Menswear on Upper Main Street and get some slacks before you head north. Pendleton's or khaki twill is fine for every day. Banlon for dress."
"Banlon?"
"Just ask, they'll know. You also need to get some dress shirts, eventually a suit, also some ties and a tie clip. Buy yourself a hat, too. Not a baseball cap, a nice summer straw."
There were tears leaking from the corners of his eyes. This frightened me more thoroughly than anything he'd said. "Al, what's wrong?"
"I'm just scared, same as you are. There's no need for an emotional parting scene, though. If you're coming back, you'll be here in 2 minutes, no matter how long you stay in 58. Just time enough for me to start the coffee maker. If it works out, we'll have a nice cup together, and you can tell me all about it."
If. What a big word. You could say a prayer, too. There'd be time for that, wouldn't there?
"Sure. I'll be praying that it goes nice and smooth. And don't get so dazed by where you are that you forget you're dealing with a dangerous man. More dangerous than Oswald, maybe. I'll be careful." "Okay. Keep your mouth shut as much as you can until you pick up the lingo and the feel of the place. Go slow. Don't make waves."
I tried to smile, but I'm not sure I made it. The briefcase felt very heavy, as if it were filled with rocks instead of money and bogus ID. I thought I might faint, and yet, God help me, part of me still wanted to go. Couldn't wait to go. I wanted to see the USA in my Chevrolet. America was asking me to call. Al held out his thin and trembling hand.
"Good luck, chick. God bless."
"George, you mean?"
"George! Right! Now get going. As they say back then, it's time for you to split the scene."
I turned and walked slowly into the pantry, moving like a man trying to locate the top of a staircase with the lights out. On my third step, I found it. Part 2. The Janitor's Father. Chapter 5. I walked along the side of the drying shed just like before. I ducked under the chain with the no admittance beyond this point sign hanging from it just like before. I walked around the corner of the big green painted cube of a building just like before, and then something smacked into me. I'm not particularly heavy for my height, but I've got some meat on my bones. "You won't blow away in a high wind," my father used to say, and still the yellow card man almost knocked me over. It was like being attacked by a black overcoat full of flapping birds. He was yelling something, but I was too startled, not scared exactly, it was all too quick for that, to have any idea what it was. I pushed him away, and he stumbled back against the drying shed with his coat swirling around his legs. There was a bonk sound when the back of his head struck the metal, and his filthy fedora tumbled to the ground. He followed it down, not in a tumble, but in a kind of accordion collapse. I was sorry for what I'd done, even before my heart had a chance to settle into a more normal rhythm, and sorrier still when he picked up his hat and began brushing at it with one dirty hand. The hat was never going to be clean again, and in all probability, neither was he. "Are you okay?" I asked, but when I bent down to touch his shoulder, he went scuttering away from me along the side of the shed, pushing with his hands and sliding on his butt. I'd say he looked like a crippled spider, but he didn't. He looked like what he was, a wino with a brain that was damp, going on wet. A man who might be as close to death as Al Templeton was, because in this 50-plus years ago America, there were probably no charity-supported shelters or rehabs for guys like him. The VA might take him if he'd ever worn the uniform, but who would take him to the VA? Nobody, probably. Although someone, a mill foreman would be the most likely, might call the cops on him. They'd put him in the drunk tank for 24 or 48 hours. If he didn't die of DT-induced convulsions while he was in there, they'd turn him loose to start the next cycle. I found myself wishing my ex-wife was here. She could find an AA meeting and take him to it. Only Christy wouldn't be born for another 21 years. I put the briefcase between my feet and held my hands out to show him they were empty, but he cringed even further down the side of the drying shed. Spittle gleamed on his stubbly chin. I looked around to be sure we weren't attracting attention, saw that we had this part of the mill yard to ourselves, and tried again. "I only pushed you because you startled me."
"Who the fuck are you?"
he asked, his voice cracking through about 5 different registers. If I hadn't heard the question on my last visit, I wouldn't have had any idea what he was asking. And although the slur was the same, wasn't the inflection a little different this time? I wasn't sure, but I thought so.
"He's harmless, but he's not like anyone else," Al had said. "It's like he knows something."
Al thought it was because he happened to be sunning himself near the rabbit hole at 11:58 in the morning on September 9, 1958, and was susceptible to its influence. The way you can produce static on a TV screen if you run a mixer close to it. Maybe that was it. Or hell, maybe it was just the booze. "Nobody important," I said in my most soothing voice. "Nobody you need to concern yourself with. My name's George. What's yours?"
"Motherfucker!"
he snarled and scrambled yet further from me. If that was his name, it was certainly an unusual one.
"You're not supposed to be here!"
"Don't worry, I'm leaving," I said. I picked up the briefcase to demonstrate my sincerity, and he hunched his thin shoulders all the way up to his ears, as if he expected me to hurl it at him. He was like a dog that's been beaten so often it expects no other treatment. No harm and no foul, okay?
"Get out! Bastard ball! Go back to where you came from and leave me alone!"
"It's a deal." I was still recovering from the startle he'd given me, and the residual adrenaline mixed badly with the pity I felt, not to mention the exasperation. The same exasperation I'd felt with Christy when I came home to discover she was drunk going on shit-faced again in spite of all her promises to straighten up, fly right, and quit the booze once and for all. The combination of emotions, added to the heat of this late summer day, was making me feel a little sick to my stomach. Probably not the best way to start a rescue mission. I thought of the Kennebec fruit and how good that root beer had been, I could see the gasp of vapor from the ice cream freezer as Frank Ancietti Sr. pulled out the big mug. Also, it had been blessedly cool in there. I started in that direction with no further ado, my new but carefully aged around the edges briefcase banging against the side of my knee.
Hey! Hey! You! Watch your face!
I turned. The wino was struggling to his feet, using the side of the drying shed as a support. He had snagged his hat and was holding it, crushed against his midsection. Now he began to fumble at it.
I got a yellow card from the green front, so give me a buck, motherfucker. Today's double money day.
We were back on message. That was comforting. Nonetheless, I took pains not to approach him too closely. I didn't want to scare him again or provoke another attack. I stopped 6 feet away and held out my hand. The coin Al had given me gleamed on my palm. I can't spare a buck, but here's half a rock. He hesitated, now holding his hat in his left hand.
You better not want a suck job.
Tempting, but I think I can resist.
Huh?
He looked from the 50-cent piece to my face, then back down at the money again. He raised his right hand to wipe the slick of drool off his chin, and I saw another difference from before. Nothing earth-shattering, but enough to make me wonder about the solidity of Al's claim that each time was a complete reset. I don't care if you take it or leave it, but make up your mind, I said. I've got things to do. He snatched the coin, then cowered back against the drying shed again. His eyes were large and wet. The slick of drool had reappeared on his chin. There's really nothing in the world that can match the glamour of a late-stage alcoholic. I can't think why Jim Beam, Seagram's, and Mike's Hard Lemonade don't use them in their magazine ads. Drink Beam and see a better class of bugs.
Who are you? What are you doing here?
A job, I hope. Listen, have you tried AA for that little problem you've got with the booze?
Fuck off, Jimla!
I had no idea what a Jimla might be. The fuck off part came through, loud and clear. I headed for the gate, expecting him to hurl more questions after me. He hadn't before, but this encounter had been markedly different. Because he wasn't the yellow card man, not this time. When he raised his hand to wipe his chin, the card clutched in it had no longer been yellow. This time, it was a dirty but still bright orange. I threaded my way through the mill parking lot, once again tapping the trunk of the white over red Plymouth Fury for good luck. I was certainly going to need all of that I could get. I crossed the train tracks once again, hearing the woof-choof of a train, only this time it sounded a little more distant, because this time my encounter with the yellow card man, who was now the orange card man, had taken a bit longer. The air stank of mill effluent as it had before, and the same intercity bus snored past. Because I was a little late this time, I couldn't read the route sign, but I remembered what it said, Lewiston Express. I wondered idly how many times Al had seen that same bus, with the same passengers looking out the windows. I hurried across the street, waving away the blue cloud of bus exhaust as best I could. The Rockabilly Rebel was at his post outside the door, and I wondered briefly what he'd say if I stole his line. But in a way that would be as mean as terrorizing the drying shed wino on purpose. If you stole the secret language belonging to kids like this, they didn't have much left. This one couldn't even go back and pound on the Xbox, so I just nodded. He nodded back. Hi-ho, daddy-o. I went inside. The bell jingled. I went past the discount comic books and straight to the soda fountain, where Frank Ancietti Sr. was standing. What can I do for you today, my friend? For a moment I was stumped, because that wasn't what he'd said before. Then I realized it wouldn't be, Last time I'd grabbed a newspaper out of the rack. This time I hadn't. Maybe each trip back to 1958 reset the odometer back to all zeros, with the exception of the yellow card man, but the first time you varied something, everything was up for grabs. The idea was both scary and liberating. "I could use a root beer," I said. "And I can use the custom. So we've got a meeting of the minds. 5 a 10-cent beer." 10, I guess." "Well, I think you guessed right." The frost-coated mug came out of the freezer. He used the handle of the wooden spoon to scrape off the foam. He filled it to the top and set it in front of me, all just like before. "That's a dime, plus one for the governor." I handed over one of Al's vintage dollars, and while Frank 1.0 made change, I looked over my shoulder and saw the former yellow card man standing outside the liquor store, the green front, and swaying from side to side. He made me think of a Hindu fakir I'd seen in some old movie tooting a horn to coax a cobra out of a wicker basket. And coming up the sidewalk, right on schedule, was Ancietti the Younger. I turned back, sipped my root beer, and sighed. "This hits the spot." "Yep, nothing like a cold beer on a hot day." "Not from around here, are you?" "No, Wisconsin." I held out my hand. "George Amberson." He shook it as the bell over the door jangled. "Frank Ancietti. And there comes my boy, Frank Jr. Say hello to Mr. Amberson from Wisconsin, Frankie." "Hello, sir." He gave me a smile and a nod, then turned to his dad. "Titus has got the truck up on the lift. Says it'll be ready by 5. "Well, that's good." I waited for Ancietti 1.0 to light a cigarette and wasn't disappointed. He inhaled, then turned back to me. "Are you traveling on business or for pleasure?" For a moment I didn't respond, but not because I was stumped for an answer. What was throwing me was the way this scene kept diverging from and then returning to the original script. In any case, Ancietti didn't seem to notice. "Either way, you picked the right time to come. Most of the summer people are gone, and when that happens, we all relax. You want a scoop of vanilla ice cream in your beer? Usually it's 5 cents extra, but on Tuesdays I reduce the price to a nickel." "You wore that one out 10 years ago, Pop," Frank Jr. said amiably. "Thanks, but this is fine," I said. "I'm on business, actually. A real estate closing up in Sabattis. I think that's it. Do you know that town?" "Only my whole life," Frank said. He jetted smoke from his nostrils, then gave me a shrewd look. "Long way to come for a real estate closing." I returned a smile that was supposed to communicate, "If you knew what I know." It must have gotten across because he tipped me a wink. The bell over the door jingled and the fruit-shopping ladies came in. The drink cheer-up coffee wall clock read 12:28, apparently the part of the script where Frank Jr. and I discussed the Shirley Jackson story had been cut from this draft. I finished my root beer in 3 long swallows, and as I did, a cramp tightened my bowels. In novels, characters rarely have to go potty, but in real life, mental stress often provokes a physical reaction. "Say, you don't happen to have a men's room, do you?" "Sorry, no," Frank Sr. said. "Keep meaning to put one in. But in the summer, we're too busy. And in the winter, there never seems to be enough cash for the renovations." "You can go around the corner to Titus," Frank Jr. said. He was scooping ice cream into a metal cylinder, getting ready to make himself a milkshake. He hadn't done that before, and I thought with some unease about the so-called butterfly effect. I thought I was watching that butterfly unfurl its wings right before my eyes. We were changing the world, only in small ways, infinitesimal ways, but yes, we were changing it. "Mister?" "I'm sorry," I said. "Had a senior moment." He looked puzzled, then laughed. "Never heard that one before, but it's pretty good." Because it was, he might repeat it the next time he lost his own train of thought, and a phrase that otherwise wouldn't enter the bright flow of American slanguage until the 70s or 80s would make an early debut. You couldn't say a premature debut, exactly, because on this time stream, It would be right on schedule.
Titus Chevron is around the corner on your right, Ancietti Sr. said. If it's, urgent, you're welcome to use our bathroom upstairs.
No, I'm fine, I said, and although I'd already looked at the wall clock, I took an ostentatious glance at my boulevard on the cool Spidel band. It was a good thing they couldn't see the face, because I'd forgotten to reset it, and it was still on 2011 time.
But I've got to be going, errands to run. Unless I'm very lucky, they'll tie me up for more than a day.
Can you recommend a good motel around here?
Do you mean a motor court? Ancietti Sr. asked.
He butted his cigarette in one of the Winston Tastes Good ashtrays that lined the counter.
Yes. This time my smile felt foolish rather than in the know. And my bowels cramped again. If I didn't take care of that problem soon, it was going to develop into an authentic 911 situation.
Motels are what we call them in Wisconsin.
Well, I'd say the Tamarack Motor Court, about 5 miles up 196 on your way to Lewiston, Ancietti Sr. said. It's near the drive-in movie.
Thanks for the tip, I said, getting up.
You bet. And if you want to get trimmed up before any of your meetings, try Bama's Barbershop. He does a real fine job.
Thanks. Another good tip.
Tips are free. Root beers are sold American.
Enjoy your time in Maine, Mr. Amberson.
And Frankie, you drink that milkshake and get on back to school.
You bet, Pop.
This time it was Junior who tipped a wink in my direction.
Frank, one of the ladies called in a yoo-hoo voice. Are these oranges fresh?
As fresh as your smile, Leola, he replied, and the ladies tee-heed.
I'm not trying to be cute here. They actually tee-heed.
I passed them, murmuring, ladies, as I went by. The bell jingled, and I went out into the world that had existed before my birth. But this time, instead of crossing the street to the courtyard where the rabbit hole was, I walked deeper into that world. Across the street, the wino in the long black coat was gesticulating at the tunic-wearing clerk. The card he was waving might be orange instead of yellow, but otherwise he was back on script. I took that as a good sign.
Titus Chevron was beyond the red and white supermarket where Al had bought the same supplies for his diner over and over again. According to the sign in the window, lobster was going for 69 cents a pound. Across from the market, standing on a patch of ground that was vacant in 2011, was a big maroon barn with the doors standing open and all sorts of used furniture on display. Cribs, cane rockers, and overstuffed easy chairs of the dad's relaxin' type seemed in particularly abundant supply. The sign over the door read, "The Jolly White Elephant." An additional sign, this one an A-frame propped to catch the eye of folks on the road to Lewiston, made the audacious claim that if we don't have it, you don't need it. A fellow I took to be the proprietor was sitting in one of the rocking chairs, smoking a pipe and looking across at me. He wore a strap-style T-shirt and baggy brown slacks. He also wore a goatee, which I thought equally audacious for this particular island in the time stream. His hair, although combed back and held in place with some sort of grease, curled down to the nape of his neck and made me think of some old rock and roll video I'd seen, Jerry Lee Lewis jumping on his piano as he sang Great Balls of Fire. The proprietor of the Jolly White Elephant probably had a reputation as the town beatnik. I tipped a finger to him. He gave me the faintest of nods and went on puffing his pipe. At the Chevron, where regular was selling for 19.9 cents a gallon and super was a penny more, a man in blue coveralls and strenuous crew cut was working on a truck, the Ancietti's, I presumed, that was up on the lift.
"Mr. Titus?" He glanced over his shoulder.
"Yeah?"
"Mr. Ancietti said I could use your restroom?"
"Key's inside the front door."
"Thank you." The key was attached to a wooden paddle with men printed on it. The other key had girls printed on the paddle. My ex-wife would have shit a brick at that, I thought, and not without glee.
The restroom was clean but smoky-smelling. There was an urn-style ashtray beside the commode. From the number of butts studding it, I would guess a good many visitors to this tidy little room enjoyed puffing as they pooped. When I came out, I saw 24 or so used cars in a small lot next to the station. A line of colored pennants fluttered above them in a light breeze, cars that would have sold for thousands, as classics no less, in 2011, were priced at $75 and $100. A Caddy that looked in nearly mint condition was going for $800. The sign over the little sales booth, inside a gum-chewing ponytailed cutie was absorbed in photoplay, read, "All these cars run good and come with the Bill Titus guarantee. We service what we sell." I hung the key up, thanked Titus, who grunted without turning from the truck on the lift, and started back toward Main Street, thinking it would be a good idea to get my hair cut before visiting the bank. That made me remember the goatee-wearing beatnik, and, on impulse, I crossed the street to the used furniture emporium. "Morning," I said.
"Well, it's actually afternoon. But whatever makes you happy."
He puffed his pipe, and that light, late-summer breeze brought me a whiff of cherry blend. Also a memory of my grandfather, who used to smoke it when I was a kid. He sometimes blew it in my ear to quell the earache, a treatment that was probably not AMA-approved. "Do you sell suitcases?"
"Oh, I got a few in my kick. No more than 200, I'd say. Walk all the way to the back and look on your right."
"If I buy one, could I leave it here for a couple of hours while I do some shopping?"
"I'm open until 5, he said, and turned his face up into the sun. "After that, you're on your own."
I traded 2 of Al's vintage dollars for a leather valise, left it behind the beatnik's counter, then walked up to Main Street with my briefcase banging my leg. I glanced into the green front and saw the clerk sitting beside the cash register and reading a newspaper. There was no sign of my pal in the black overcoat. It would have been hard to get lost in the shopping district. It was only a block long. 3 or 4 storefronts up from the Kennebec Fruit, I came to Baumer's barber shop. A red and white barber pole twirled in the window. Next to it was a political poster featuring Edmund Muskie. I remembered him as a tired, slope-shouldered old man, but this version of him looked almost too young to vote, let alone get elected to anything. The poster read, "Send Ed Muskie to the U.S. Senate. Vote Democrat." Someone had put a bright white band around the bottom. Hand-printed on it was, "They said it couldn't be done in Maine, but we did it." Next up, Humphrey in 1960. Inside, 2 old parties were sitting against the wall, while an equally old third party got his tonsure trimmed. Both of the waiting men were puffing like choo-choos. So was the barber. Baumer, I assumed, with one eye squinted against the rising smoke as he clipped. All 4 studied me in a way I was familiar with, the not-quite-mistrustful look of appraisal that Christie once called the Yankee glare. It was nice to know that some things hadn't changed. "I'm from out of town, but I'm a friend," I told them. "Voted the straight Democratic ticket my whole life." I raised my hand in a so-help-me-God gesture. Baumer grunted with amusement. Ash tumbled from his cigarette. He brushed it absently off his smock and onto the floor, where there were several crushed butts among the cut hair.
"Harold there's a Republican. You want to watch out, he don't bite you."
"He ain't got the chopper's foot no more,"
one of the others said, and they all cackled.
"Where are you from, mister?" Harold the Republican asked.
"Wisconsin." I picked up a copy of Man's Adventure to forestall further conversation. On the cover, a subhuman Asian gent with a whip in one gloved hand was approaching a blonde lovely tied to a post. The story that went with it was called "Jap Sex Slaves of the Pacific." The barbershop smell was a sweet and completely wonderful mixture of talcum powder, pomade, and cigarette smoke. By the time Baumer motioned me to the chair, I was deep into the sex slave story. It wasn't as exciting as the cover. "Been doing some traveling, Mr. Wisconsin?" he asked as he settled a white rayon cloth over my front.